like the Lord. Long hair on his head, his neck it was red, and he was driving an old beat up Ford. Well, his tailgate was covered with stickers: love your mother and blow up a dam, make love not war, don't drill oil offshore, and get livestock off our public land. He was smoking a humble hooter. Oh Lord, it tasted divine. So I asked him what gives. He just said, "Hey, Duke lives," and Aunt Abby was a good friend of mine. And he looked a whole lot like Jesus. He looked just like the Lord. Long hair on his head, his neck it was red, and he was driving an old beat up Ford. Well, he had a green fist on his t-shirt, a monkey wrench pierced in his ear. He spoke of the trees and he cursed corporate sleaze while he guzzled a six pack of beer. As we entered the National Forest, I wondered what we's gonna do. He said, "I'm a going monkey wrenching at the Round River Rendezvous." And I remember that night by the campfire light, Judy Berry was fiddling so fine. When he mumbled to me, "Let's go back a tree and cut down some power lines." But he looked a whole lot Jesus. He looked just like the Lord. Long hair on his head, his neck it was red, and he was driving an old beat-up Ford. So now I'm sitting in prison, a jumpsuit and flip-flops I wear. I'll be out with good time by 2009. I hope there still be some old growth. He sure ain't a sharing myself, 'cause he was a spy for the FBI, and they busted Dave Mormon as well. And I remember that night by the campfire light, Judy Berry was a fiddling so fine. When he mumbled to me, "Let's go spike a tree and cut down some." But he looked a whole lot like Jesus. He looked just like the Lord. Long hair on his head, his neck it was red, and he was driving an old beat-up Ford.
And now the host of the Environment Show, Remedy.
All right, hey everybody, tuning in to the Environment Show. This is Remedy.
I'm in touch with all my feelings. I've read poems and...
There we go. All right. Okay, everybody, thanks for tuning in. This is Remedy. I am filling in for Duff this evening. And tonight we are going to have a live call-in show. The number here is 923-3911. And that was an introductory song by the famous Daryl Churney. He looked a whole lot like Jesus. Sung by Peg Millett, who was famously framed by the FBI and spent 3 years in prison because of that. And that's an appropriate song to start out this show because tonight we're going to talk about the Green Scare, which is a current thing that's going on in our country. Starting on December 7th, 2005, the FBI began arresting environmental activists alleging arson and other acts of sabotage that took place between 1998 and 2001 in the Pacific Northwest. And the arrests have occurred in Oregon, California, Washington State, New York, Arizona, maybe even a couple other places. But tonight we're going to have a guest, Karen Pickett, who's a longtime Earth First activist, is going to join us to talk about what is going on with the Green Scare and what's going on. Karen, are you there with us?
I am here.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Boy, you know, there's so much going on with this particular issue that I had a hard time coming up with a brief introductory little blurb about what's happening. So maybe we should just talk about what is the history of this? You know, how did we get to this place where we're having dozens of activists have been arrested at this point? Isn't it somewhere more than 20? And this is not a new thing for the FBI to be calling environmental activists terrorists. This has been happening for a long time. In fact, back in 1990, they were saying that about Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. And, you know, what's the connection between then and now?
Well, there's, I can relate to the difficulty in coming up with a synopsis blurb, and the same is kind of true of the history, because the history is long, but it's I think it's really important to recognize that this has a history, and I think that what's happening now is not something that is happening because of the result of a long investigation or a big break in the investigation necessarily. I think that it's something that is calculated and planned and political, and as you say, with history. And there's a long history of the FBI infiltration, disruption, and prosecution of people in the progressive movement, and basically the parts of the political movement that challenge the status quo in this country. And that's a very long history. There's a shorter history of the FBI's infiltration and disruption and prosecution of the more radical parts of the environmental movement. But the fact that what's happening now, even though there are many similarities to what happened during the Arizona 5 arrest and trial in Arizona, and during the attempted charging of Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney with possession of explosives after Judy was almost killed by the bomb that was planted in her car in 1990, the playing out of some of those same kinds of tactics that the FBI has used for a long time in today's political landscape makes things very different. And, you know, the word terrorist is a very hot button kind of word, and it evokes images today that it simply didn't back then.
Right, and they were actually using those words during the Arizona 5 trial. Didn't they have big exhibits where they had the big word terrorist in big bold letters that they were showing to the jury?
Right. I was at that trial in 1991, and the prosecutor had this huge flip chart with, you know, like 2.5 foot by 3 foot piece of paper, and with the word terrorist written across it, and the whole presentation was done with a great deal of drama. And, you know, it wasn't terrorism then. It was vandalism and it was sabotage, and it's not terrorism now. And in 1990, you know, the way that they tried to set up Judy and Daryl for the prosecution of carrying explosives was immediately, they were on TV saying, these people are known terrorists, they're connected with a known terrorist group, which of course was Earth First, and they attempted to marginalize them. And, you know, when people are marginalized and you erode their support, then it's a lot easier to prosecute them. And that's exactly what they're trying to do with the people that were arrested through these indictments.
Yeah, and it seems like it'd be a much more powerful thing now at this point to, because they seem to be calling out a lot of the buzzwords. You know, they're saying that it's eco-terrorism or that it's terrorism at all. And they're using this term, the family, to describe the people who've been arrested. But that's just something that they pulled out of the blue, from what I understand.
Right. It has nothing to do with any reality. I don't know all of the people that were arrested, but it's, you know, they're all activists, and so their history is known. And not all of these people even know each other, much less were operating in any kind of a group that would be called a family. And it's a, you know, it's really an unveiled attempt to to bring up this image of the Manson family. But the Manson family were cold-blooded murderers, and these people are animal rights activists and environmental activists.
Right, and whether or not they actually committed any of the things that they've been charged with, because it seems like the evidence is pretty weak, the fact remains that no one was hurt in any of these.
Right, and we don't know yet, and one of the things that happens when people are branded as terrorists and the prosecution is done with this level of sensationalism, and they're marginalized, is that they lose their right of a presumption of innocence until the trial. And the trial is many months away, and there, you know, we don't know how many of these people, or if any of these people, were actually involved in the acts that they're alleging. You know, in some cases, there were arrests in California, which were actually, it's part of this same sweep. It wasn't actually out of this grand jury in Oregon, but it's a similar kind of prosecution, and it's definitely part of this larger sweep. The people were charged with conspiring to commit acts. You know, there wasn't even anything that happened. And of course, Rod Coronado, who was indicted from the grand jury in San Diego, his charges have to do with giving a speech, a public speech. And he was talking about something that he was convicted of and did prison time for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's all the language is an attempt to marginalize people, but there is so little known at this point in time in terms of how they gathered their evidence and what kind of evidence they really have, that they, of course, deserve the right to a presumption of innocence until they go to trial.
Certainly. So there are multiple grand juries that have been... Did the grand juries actually investigate themselves? Is that their job, or they just recommend charges or something like that?
Well, they issue indictments, and actually just reading about grand juries. I mean, I think that the general public knows very little about the grand jury system, and it's really counter to the what people think of as our judicial system. And supposedly it was originally conceived of as a protection against overzealous federal prosecutors, so that, you know, there was this jury involved. But in fact, it's been, you know, it quickly abandoned those original intentions and has been used throughout U.S. history to prosecute people with unpopular political views. And the thing with grand juries is that the indictments can be based on hearsay evidence, and which is not admissible in regular court. The prosecution selects all of the witnesses, and it's not run by a judge, as happens in regular court. And so everything is so skewed that almost always the grand juries are basically rubber stamping the charges that the prosecution is attempting to bring against people. And in fact, there was this statistic that in the year 2000, federal grand juries indicted a total of almost 60,000 people. It was 59,470 people. And there were only 29 people who were not indicted. So that supports the argument that it's really just a rubber stamp for what the prosecution is trying to do. So they convene these grand juries, and they're also totally secret. So, you know, there's a grand jury, there's one in San Diego, there's one in Oregon that issued most of these indictments. There was one that just convened recently in Colorado, and those of us engaged in the discussion about these grand juries were tracking the fact that somebody from Oregon had been subpoenaed to go and testify before this grand jury in Colorado. And we were talking about it publicly and saying, you know, well, you know, we think this is the first person that's being subpoenaed before this grand jury. And usually, you know, if you're tracking court cases, you know what's going on. But we were saying it in that way because the only way that you know who is going before a grand jury to testify is if they happen to be people in your circle and they tell you, I've been subpoenaed before the grand jury, because everything is secret, not accessible to the public. And so we don't know whether other people were called before that grand jury. And then when people go to testify, they don't have the benefit of having their attorney with them.
Right,
they're questioned.
They can't even have an attorney in the room with them while they're being questioned.
Right, right. The best they get is that they can go out in the hallway and consult with their attorney, but they're usually compelled to testify as well, which means, you know, the people who think that they can invoke their Fifth Amendment right, which generally you can do in regular court, generally you cannot in a grand jury, and refusal to testify often means being held in contempt of court and being sent to jail for the life of the grand jury, which is usually 18 months.
Wow. That's crazy. So I was interested in, you said that, you know, they're being charged with conspiracy, and I'm being charged with conspiracy in a civil suit by Pacific Lumber, and I've noticed that they use the word and the allegation of conspiracy as an excuse to do these sweeping, well, you could call it investigation when you're talking about a grand jury, or just discovery when you're talking about a civil suit such as ours, where they think that it's all right to just stick their nose in every possible hole in order to try to find some connection. And, you know, it's like, one person's conspiracy is another person's movement, and it seems like these days they're really trying to squash any kind of movement in order by labeling it as a conspiracy and keeping people afraid to get involved. And
right, because it can cover such a broad category of activities, because really conspiracy is talking about something, and you know, and then they turn it into planning something. But it also is used because it greatly increases penalties. And if there was a misdemeanor committed, the conspiracy to commit that misdemeanor can be a felony. So it automatically ramps up the possible penalties.
So what do you think is the reason why this is happening now? This, you know, all these arrests started happening on December 7th of 2005. What do you think about the timing of these arrests?
Well, several things. I think that, as I said, I don't think that this is the culmination of a long investigation, although I do believe that the infiltration of the radical environmental movement has been going on for quite some time. And I don't think that it was due primarily to a break in the investigation, although we found out that they do have informants that are being paid pretty large sums of money. I think it has more to do with the fact that there were these actions. There were actually 17 different incidents in a number of different states that are called up in the indictments. And some of those actions, they're primarily actions that the Earth Liberation Front, ELF, or in some cases the Animal Liberation Front, ALF, took responsibility for. And they happened over this period of years, and for some of those actions, the statute of limitations was about to expire, and they had not been able to break the cases. And the fact that they hadn't been able to break the cases, of course, was a source of great frustration and chagrin for law enforcement. But because they were about to lose some of those cases with the expiration of the statute, then I think that is part of the reason. And I think that, you know, it's also the fact that they named ELF as the number one threat in terms of domestic terrorism. The FBI named them as the number one, as their number one priority for their domestic terrorism arm. About a year ago, they had hearings in a congressional subcommittee a year ago, and they tried to make a big deal out of the ELF being this huge threat, you know, even while all of these other acts of real terrorism, because people have been killed and people have been injured, and there are crimes like, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing. And even while a lot of the crimes that could be called terrorism have gone unprosecuted, when they made that announcement, even though it really didn't make any logical sense, you know that once they commit those resources and put themselves on the line and make that announcement, that you're going to see product for it sooner or later. And I think that that's also one of the reasons. And there's also this climate that has been created not only by law enforcement, but by the business community and the business lobby. And I think that this is also a large part of the reason that this is happening now. And a lot of the new laws that are making their way onto books through the legislature, mostly at the state level, and a lot of the proposals for enhanced sentencing are coming not so much from the law enforcement community, but from the business lobby, and by and large from this organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council. And I think that these new laws that they are basically paying to have put on the books that are basically corporate property protection laws, and it's protection of wealth laws, branding property destruction as terrorism, and then bringing with it increased penalties and opportunities for a different kind of prosecution. So that's created this landscape, this climate, that these crimes can be prosecuted in an altogether different way.
Mm-hmm. That's not surprising. But, you know, it's funny when you look back at the history of the United States, you know, and different acts of civil disobedience, including sabotage, that have been committed, which are now celebrated, you know, like the Boston Tea Party stands
right
out, or, you know, different acts of sabotage that happened in response to the Fugitive Slave Act, in which people were breaking slaves out of jails, and so that they wouldn't be returned to a life of slavery. So this isn't, you know, a new thing in our American history.
Right.
So what kind of jail terms are the people facing who've been arrested with these crimes, or because of the alleged crimes?
Well, they're talking about decades in prison, and for some of the people they're talking about life sentences plus years on top of the life sentences. And it's you know, it's different for each person, and it's also a landscape that keeps changing, because they've, you know, initially people were arrested in December, and then these indictments came down from the grand jury in Eugene, Oregon, on January 20th, and so the people who were arrested in December, their charges were basically abandoned, and they were superseded by these indictments. They were brought into the indictment, so it was a larger group, and then it was these federal indictments. And since then, there have been more people added, and there's then been a superseding indictment. And it's clear, and the information that's coming from the attorneys working on this case indicates that we're still very much in the middle of this. It's you know, it's an actively unfolding situation, and it's difficult to say where it will go. It's very difficult to say how many people are will be caught up in this huge sweep. But it's really created a climate of fear in the activist community. But it's also, you know, people are rising to the occasion and challenging the grand jury system and challenging the whole machine that's carrying out this sweep. But I would expect that there will be more superseding indictments. So, you know, it's hard to say how many charges they will have against people when they actually go to trial, and what that will constitute in terms of the sentences that are being threatened. But, you know, there's one of the attorneys just did some research on comparative sentencing, and most of these crimes were arsons. And as you say, they're, you know, arson is a scary thing, and it's a serious crime. There's no doubt about it. But it's not the kind of arson where, you know, a building was set on fire that was full of people. As you said, there were no injuries and certainly no deaths. And in some cases, what was burned was things like a horse corral that was being used to contain wild horses that were being sent to slaughter to be used for dog food. And I'm not going to be an apologist for arson, because it is a scary crime. Nonetheless, it's not being represented accurately or truthfully in these indictments, or in the information that the FBI is giving to the media at all. And if you look at the sentences that people get for arson when they're not done for environmental reasons, and, you know, this comes from the FBI's own language, that they say, you know, these same crimes, when they're done for reasons to protect animals or for environmental reasons, then that's when we come in with the enhanced sentencing. And regular arson, the usual sentence is about 6 years. It's not decades in prison. And in fact, there's a huge irony, because this guy, Michael Fortier, who was one of the people who was convicted of planning the Oklahoma City bombing, where 168 people were killed, was released from jail after serving a sentence of 10 years the same day these indictments came down. And there's no connection, except when you hear about the sentences that they're threatening these people with.
Wow. That's very interesting. So let me take this opportunity to remind people that you are listening to KMUD, the Environment Show. I'm Remedy, and we're talking to Karen Pickett about the Green Scare. This is a call-in show. You can call us at 923-3911 if you have any questions or comments. We talked a little bit about the implication for the environmentalist and the environmental movement, and how it intimidates people and makes it easier to prosecute these people. What do you think are the implications for everybody else? I mean, we are having this conversation at a time where there is unprecedented spying by the government on citizens, you know, wiretapping and, you know, any electronic communication, it seems like you really got to be careful with. What kind of implications do you think this has on normal people who don't necessarily think of themselves as part of a movement?
Well, I think that the implications are huge, and which is why it's so important to prevent these people from being marginalized, because, you know, it's like that famous quote, you know, first they came for the Jews and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew, and it goes on down the line until when they come for you, there's nobody left to defend you. And I have always been convinced since 1990, when Judy was almost killed by the bomb, that what prevented the FBI from going ahead with their prosecution of Judy and Daryl was the fact that this alliance emerged and stood beside Earth First and said, these people are not terrorists. And it was this broad-based alliance that was people from mainstream environmental groups, but not only environmental groups, it also included groups like the National Organization for Women and a couple of elected representatives. And we've been doing outreach to more mainstream groups and elected representatives kind of in that same vein, because back then the fact that those people stood up and prevented Judy and Daryl and Earth First from being marginalized, I have always believed, is what made the difference. There was a shift, and they weren't able to marginalize these people, and I think that that's what we need to do now. And I think that people who maybe figure this is something that is that doesn't touch their lives, because, you know, even if they're politically aware, politically active, they wouldn't ever use tactics like this. I think that they're kidding themselves, and particularly when you throw the covers off one of the major underlying agendas, which is protection of private property, in particular protection of corporate property and protection of wealth, then you look at some of the other strategies that are used by the more mainstream environmental groups, like not only civil disobedience, but like market campaigns and boycotts and strikes. You know, all of those strategies are designed to affect the bottom line and bring about change by asserting that economic pressure. And so if you understand that part of the agenda behind this increased prosecution of people, and outrageous prosecution of people, is the protection of private property, then where does that leave us? You don't have to be a wild-eyed radical employing these tactics that probably only a small minority of activists would ever consider.
Right. One thing you said really struck me when you said that, you know, it was the alliance that built up around Judy and Daryl that really stopped the FBI from prosecuting. But it seems to me one of the other things that kept the prosecution from happening was that there wasn't any evidence, you know, that the FBI raided Daryl and Judy's homes and collected, you know, markers and duct tape and nails, you know, finishing nails from the trim around Judy's windows or something to that effect. To try to come up with evidence when there really wasn't any.
Right. Yeah. Well, but they fabricated evidence, and they lied. And this is what came out in court when we finally won in 2002, was that it was a smear campaign against these individuals and against Earth First, and that they used all these lies in order to smear the people that they were trying to smear. So, you know, that leaves us to question how much of what they're saying now has anything to do with the truth. I mean, the huge lies that they used just to get the arrest warrants and just to get the search warrants back with Judy and Daryl included things like, you know, saying that the bomb was in the back seat, and while they had possession of the car with this huge gaping hole right underneath the front seat. And, you know, people have heard all these stories over and over now, but back then, we didn't have possession of that physical evidence. So when they said things like, the bomb exploded in the back seat, the nails matched, and we didn't have the car and we didn't have the nails, then their story is what made it into the headlines. So when we look at the information that the FBI is feeding the media now, can we assume that it has much of anything to do with the truth, or can we assume that it has to do with their agenda?
Right. And it, from my understanding, is the only evidence that they have is testimony from an informant.
Right. They have a couple of informants. I mean, their primary informant is a heroin addict that they dangled $50,000 reward in front of his nose, and he bit, because that's a good chunk of drug money. And they also, when you read the indictments, and a lot of these legal papers too, if people are interested, there's a lot of the legal documents, including the indictments, up on the website of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, and it's www.cldc.org, and it's not light reading, it's not bedtime reading, but it's really interesting. And every single one of the, it's a 65 count indictment, and every single one of these counts describes people, so and so and so and so and so and so were at this location, and you know, they went and picked up a bucket and they put gasoline in it, or whatever it is they're describing. And every single count includes a person known to the government. And I don't think that that's the informant, because the informant gave them information after the fact. And what it sounds like, in the spirit of the Arizona 5 case, is that it's a government agent, and most probably an agent provocateur. I mean, when you see that this person known to the government was involved in all of this, in all of these activities, if it was a government agent, it meant that none of these things happened without the involvement of the agent provocateur. And I'm, you know, I'm reading something into that, but I'm reading something into it because of the history that we already know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So the trial is in October, is that right?
Well, it is in October. It's scheduled for the end of October, but many of the attorneys also feel that that date will be delayed, and it will be somewhat later than that. And the fact that there are still people that have not been able to bail out and are still in prison, you know, it brings that issue up as a very important issue, because if they have to sit in jail until the trial, for one thing, it puts them at a tremendous disadvantage in terms of preparing a defense case to these very serious charges. So that's the earliest that it would be, but it's probably going to be later.
Mm-hmm. There was a news story, I think it was last week, here on KMUD. Ben Rosenfeld was interviewed by Estelle Fennell, talking about it was a motion to quash a subpoena of an indie media activist who had some video of a protest, an anti-G8 protest that mm-hmm. happened. And one of the things he said was that the FBI was working with the law enforcement agencies, and how there was an improper relationship going on there. Do you know much about that? Because I was looking at actually a press release that was put out by, I think it was by the FBI, that talked about the different departments and bodies that were involved in this supposed 9-year investigation. That's what they're saying it is, that this current, all these indictments are based on a 9-year investigation. And it's, you know, the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, and the Eugene Police Department, and the Portland Police Bureau, and the Forest Service, and BLM, and the Lane County Sheriff's Office, and all of this. I mean, do you know anything about how those groups are supposed to work together or not? I mean, in this most recent thing in Denver, you know, there was a protest where the police department took pictures of the license plates of the protesters, and it was a legal protest. But then the police department then forwarded the license plates to the FBI. So it seems, you know, that are these groups supposed to be working together? And do you know about this thing with Josh Wolf?
Well, I went to the hearing of the motion to quash last week, and we had a little press conference outside just before, and so I was in court and listened to the arguments, and the attorney that was arguing for the activist, Josh Wolf, was charging that the FBI was carrying out an illegal fishing expedition aimed at gathering information for investigations being carried out by the San Francisco police and San Francisco prosecutors. So that's what I don't know, is because I'm not schooled in law, how they're constrained, and like you say, you know, how much they can work together. But so much of this happens behind the scenes that, you know, until this comes up in court, or until somebody challenges how information is shared, and because the FBI has more resources, arguably, than local law enforcement, and you know, federal officers have different kind of powers than local police departments, and then there's, you know, the whole grand jury system. So it's, you know, they're definitely amping this up, and what they're supposed to be doing, if they were all obeying the law, is something that I don't really know. But it does appear that this subpoena for this young videographer did have to do with a fishing expedition. And he right after court, he had a great quote. He said that if the subpoena for him and for his videotape were allowed to stand, that means that any journalist who covers anything related to a crime is essentially de facto working as an investigator for the state without choice.
Boy, that's a real chilling effect on journalists.
Yeah, and clearly, you know, all of this, I mean, you know, the goal is prosecution, and the goal is squashing the radical environmental movement in some of these cases, but basically also squashing the progressive movement. But kind of more immediately, it's clear that they're trying to create a climate of fear so that the people will be afraid to carry out, you know, not to carry out arson, because I think the people are already afraid to carry out arson. You know, arson is already illegal, and property damage is already illegal. But there's actually in this flurry of new possible laws in the books and enhanced sentencing, there's a bill that's in the Pennsylvania state legislature right now that is supposed to be, it could become law in 10 days. It's already been through the House, and I'm not sure where it is at the moment, but it could become law in 10 days. And it would increase the severity of charges and sentencing in civil disobedience activities if they interfere with people engaged in resource extraction, agricultural research, or animal experimentation.
Wow.
So it takes civil disobedience, which, you know, obviously has a long and revered tradition in this country, and says that you know, if you carry it out against corporations, logging corporations, mining corporations, corporations, you know, Monsanto producing GMOs or the vivisection industry, these particular sectors of industry, then your charges and possible sentences are much more severe.
Yeah, despite the fact that those corporations cost, you know, millions of dollars in damages because of their activity, which is, you know, often extra legal. I've got a list here of ExxonMobil. Let's see, this is during the 90s, cost about $125 million in fines. Louisiana Pacific, $37 million, Chevron, $6.5 million, Chemical Waste Management, $3 million, Unocal, $1.5 million. So, you know, and just thinking about, of course, Pacific Lumber, who has racked up hundreds of violations against environmental laws, you know, there's no fines for the damage that they do. And even when they actually are hurting people, because people are being harmed by their activities, so... That's crazy. I want to go back to the American Legislative Exchange Council, the lobbying group that you mentioned. And so they're writing legislation that undermines environmental laws.
Right. And in fact, this being called an eco-terrorism bill in Pennsylvania that I just mentioned. When somebody alerted me to that, I asked if she knew whether it was a bill that was, if the language was originally written by ALEC, because that's exactly what they do. It's exactly the kind of law that they are bringing up in state legislatures around the country.
Wow.
And so I haven't been able to get to verify that it is an ALEC piece of legislation, in part because one of the things about ALEC is that the corporate lobbyists and the legislators that are members of this organization sit down at the table and hash out these issues, and then model legislation is written. And by the time the legislation is on the floor being debated in the state legislature and becoming law, it doesn't necessarily have the fingerprints of ALEC on it. Mm-hmm. So people don't necessarily know. And so my suspicion is that that law in Pennsylvania is an ALEC law, but it's just a good example of the kind of thing that they do. But they also they write literally hundreds of pieces of legislation, some of which become law, some of which, you know, morph into the next generation, then it comes up in the next session. But they write hundreds of pieces of legislation each year.
Hey, Karen, we actually have a call.
Let's
go ahead and caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Remedy. This is Bruce Laffey from Los Angeles.
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. I want to tell your listeners that I was a so-called, quote-unquote, independent filmmaker from L.A. In March 17th, 2003, up in Remedy's tree, filming her, quote-unquote, independent filmmaker, because Pacific Lumber didn't believe that I was. I was put on a slap suit, still trying to figure out what to do about it. And the more you guys talk about conspiracy, the more I read while I'm listening that every page that their lawyers give me, every other page has conspiracy written in it. And a couple things that here mentioning, just real quick, I'll write. The influence of strong political environmental beliefs does not make their actions, which would be Earth First, legal. And then it says Islamic homicide bombers make that same claim. And I was wondering, just a real quick question, when it comes to Earth First activists, is it kind of scary for them to admit to be Earth First, or, you know, when it comes to that, because of this green scare?
That's a good question. Karen, do you want to answer that?
If I understand the question correctly, I'm not afraid to admit I'm an Earth First activist. I'm proud to be an Earth First activist. How much the climate of fear that they're trying to create, how much that's working is difficult to say at this point. But what I see, because we've learned the history of FBI disruption and infiltration and their dirty tactics over the years, I think that people are standing up in a way that they haven't stood up to it before, even though the whole thing is very frightening. And so I don't see people shying away from organizations or the campaigns that they're working on.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like some of the stuff I'm just reading right now where it says tree sitting was invented by Earth First, and it's a frequent topic of the organization's propaganda and training materials, and this overwhelming evidence of conspiracy and activity amongst the defendants. It's just that all these words seem, you know, like, you know, that we are terrorists, or, you know, anybody involved is terrorist.
Well, you know, Bruce, I'm actually glad that you started reading some of that garbage, because that
I have. It's so funny. Ironically, they must have cut three trees down to send me. I get packets every day from their lawyers.
Yeah, I know. It's sometimes I open my mailbox and there's five pieces of mail from PL's attorneys and Eric Schatz's attorney. And what you were reading there is actually something written by Eric Schatz's attorney. And he is, you know, he's a zealot. You know, he's very much an anti-activist, anti-environmentalist type of person who uses all these very inflammatory words and descriptions in order to, you know, boost the appearance of his client, who, you know, needs a boost really based on his previous activities. And, you know, when I think about and read about what's going on with the Green Scare and what these prosecutors are saying in the hearings, I haven't been to any of the hearings for the people who are being charged because of the grand jury indictments. I can easily imagine, you know, the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that they are using to the judge, even if it has no basis, because that's exactly what the lawyers in our case are doing. And I wanted to make one other comment about the fact that you got sued in this slap suit, Bruce, because, you know, notably the New York Times did not get sued, and neither did CBS, and neither did the Today Show, or neither did any of these other larger media outlets. But, you know, you got sued. It's very arbitrary, our case, and just to deviate for a second about our case, it's the Pacific Lumber versus Remedy et al. And, you know, they just sort of threw this wide net over people, and they grabbed some people and let other people go, and it really didn't seem to make much sense. You know, there was one defendant who they decided to dismiss from the case because he was just a photographer, but I don't understand why they didn't let you go for being just a videographer. it doesn't really seem to make any sense. So
yeah, I would have been proud if 2020 I got involved too.
Yeah, really. I mean, yeah, sue the New York Times. I mean, come on.
The ladder of filmmaker.
Right. Let's make it exciting.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for calling in, Bruce. And
okay.
We should talk soon about your situation.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye. Okay. Bye. Karen Pickett, are you still there?
I'm here.
You were once even a proud defendant on that case, and thank goodness you got away.
Yeah, it was actually the second time I've been sued by PL.
What happened the first time?
It was way back in 1987. I think it was the first time that they sued protesters. But we ended up negotiating with our criminal case, which they kept saying it wasn't linked, it wasn't linked, it wasn't linked, and of course it was. And so we ended up getting them to drop the slap suit so that they wouldn't have 8 criminal trials to deal with, all with court-appointed attorneys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I was involved in another slap suit in Idaho, which we lost, and there was $1 million judgment lodged against the protesters by the road building company. And I think that, you know, there's it's on a different level, different tactic, but it's the same kind of tactic used against protesters that are, you know, horror of horrors, trying to affect the bottom line of a corporation in the extractive industry. And it's, you know, if you cause a little bit of downtime, it's interfering with business, and that's the basis of these slap suits.
Right.
So it's more of the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that there was just the trial. The Pacific Lumber went to trial against Kim Starr, and they rolled out all the rhetoric, all the eco-terrorist rhetoric, and we were so scared and we were so terrified, even though there was video showing that they weren't scared and terrified. And I don't think there was any business lost to Pacific Lumber that day. And, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, she did lose the case, but the judgment that was against her was so small as to be, you know, insignificant, really. I mean, Pacific Lumber can't get a Humboldt County jury to, you know, to lodge a big judgment against these extremists, as they're calling us. You know, PL's property manager just had a editorial in the paper last week that, you know, called activists extremists and all of that nonsense. I think that really says something, that the jury wasn't all that.
Right. They didn't really win their case.
Right.
You know, except technically, legally,
right,
they did.
Right.
They, you know, because of the amount of money that they had to spend pursuing it, they didn't really win their case.
Right. So it is 7:55. We would have time for another caller if someone did want to call in with a quick question, 923-3911. Karen, what can people do to, I don't know, get involved or get knowledgeable, or what can people do to deal with this green scare?
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, information is powerful, and people, in order to counter what's in the corporate media, people can inform themselves, because this is, as I said, this is very actively unfolding, and it's definitely a story to watch that's going to get bigger and bigger. And so I can rattle off a couple of information sources that are good places to go. One is, there's a website called www.fbiwitchhunt. And it looks at in a broad view a bunch of the grand juries that are happening, and then in terms of the eco cases, as they're called, specifically the Civil Liberties Defense Center website that I mentioned before, CLDC, and the Portland Indie Media has been the best indie media site in terms of keeping on top of this stuff and reporting very good stories on a regular basis. And also the American Legislative Exchange Council, which, you know, this is something that we have to fight. We have to defeat this bill in Pennsylvania, but these are proposals that are going to be coming up all over the place. And so that's a front that people can get active on, to expose and fight back against the American Legislative Exchange Council. And if you go to their website, which is www.alec.com, you can get a sense of who they are and what they do. And there's also a website that's called Alec Watch, alecwatch.org. I'm pretty sure it's .org. That was put up by NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Defenders of Wildlife, those two environmental organizations, and there's a lot of good information there. Because as we were starting to mention before, their agenda is not just to make environmental activists to look like terrorists, but they have takings legislation and legislation that is meant to undermine the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and health care reform, and just this whole broad spectrum that is the progressive agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. That's all very helpful. I actually was just looking at the Portland Indie Media, which is portland.indiemedia.org, and they have a page set up called the Green Scare page that will go back through all the articles that have been posted there, and all kinds of links to help people understand what's happening. And it certainly doesn't sound like this is over, and it sounds like there will be more arrests. And since the grand jury thing is so secretive, we don't really know what's going on. So
right, and people need to support each other too. And the best antidote to all of this stuff is community. And people need to get informed about what grand juries are, so that, you know, if somebody that they know, or if they are called before the grand jury, they understand what their rights are. And there's somebody, Jeff Hogue, who's being called in a subpoena before the grand jury in Eugene on April 20th, and that's the next time that there's going to be some kind of a public event. There'll probably be a rally at the federal building in Eugene to support Jeff, because he does not plan to offer testimony to the grand jury.
Great. Okay, well, it is the top of the hour, so we do need to end there. But Karen, thank you very much for joining us here on the Environment Show. And we look forward to hearing from you always, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again. So.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for doing the show, Randy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, thanks a lot, everybody, for tuning into the Environment Show.